Dave Fanning on 2FM.
2FM.
Okay, tensions have continued to rise, as you well know, between the United States and Iran over the last couple of weeks following the death of Iran's most powerful military commander. The world watches nervously as the two nations appear to balance on the brink of war. But how did we actually get here? And what's likely to happen next? Well, Graham Finley is the lecturer from the School of Politics at UCD, who's been with us a few times before, and this time to fill us in, Graham. Thank you very much indeed for coming into the programme this morning. How did we get here, Graham? What led to the killing of Soleimani?
Well, Qasem Soleimani was a really, really important figure in Iran, and it's a very complicated politics, famously, in the Middle East. But he was the leader of the Quds Force, of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, which is the elite military, but doesn't really describe how powerful the Islamic Revolutionary Guards are in Iran. They're like a conglomerate. They have huge business interests and so forth. Anyway, he was the guy who did all the military actions outside of Iran. So he was, for decades, he'd been involved and active in Lebanon, Iraq, and now Syria. And so in the complex politics, he had actually led to the deaths by providing weapons to Iran's proxy groups in Iraq of hundreds of Americans. And so when Donald Trump had the opportunity to take him out, he chose it, unlike previous administrations. Both the Obama administration and the Bush administration had a chance to kill Soleimani, and they decided not to, because he wasn't just another terrorist. He was a terrorist, but a major official in another country. And so through all of his activities all over the region, he had led to a lot of destruction. What had happened was, with the defeat of ISIS, which he was loosely cooperating with the Americans to do, the Americans sort of pulled back from the front lines against ISIS into their camps. They were then attacked by militias, which Soleimani was sort of influencing and running for Iran. The militias the Americans were attacked by the militias. The militias were then bombed by the Americans. The militias then attacked an embassy. And the big thing for Donald Trump was that it was an embassy which was under attack, because they remembered the Benghazi embassy, where the American in Libya, where there was an attack on the embassy. The American ambassador was killed. One of his aides was killed. Two CIA contractors were killed. And the Republicans have been going on about it ever since and have had a number of investigations. So long story short, Donald Trump didn't want another attack on an embassy with possible loss of American life on his watch. And so he decided to take the unprecedented step of killing Soleimani with a drone, which fired a couple of missiles into his car.
Could it have been done less dramatically, and would therefore, like, for instance, like, you know, if there's 80 million people or more in Iran, and there's all different factions maybe against each other or fighting against each other, as they supposedly all fight with America against ISIS or whatever, that with all of that happening, is it possible that the one person who has united all of Iran is Donald Trump?
It's true. And again, one of the whole things about the Iraq war and its instability is it's handed tremendous power to Iran. And you're right. At the moment when Donald Trump killed Qasem Soleimani, there were massive protests against the regime, and not just from students or sort of middle-class people, but from working-class people who are the backbone of the regime's support. And these were are the worst protests the Islamic Republic has seen. They had direct attacks on Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, and they'd had to kill possibly up to 1,500 of their own people, which is an unprecedented amount of violence to be using against the people just to quell these protests. And now, anybody who speaks out against the regime is going to be seen as a tool of the United States. And it's united Iran in ways which the regime couldn't have dreamed about 2 weeks ago.
Well, hold on. How does the whole thing work? I mean, there's a supreme leader, as opposed to a wannabe dictator, say, in the United States of America. and then there's a president who I presume is responsible for implementing the Constitution or whatever. So, like, this supreme leader, whatever he says goes. And I presume it's always a he, isn't it?
It's extremely complicated, and it is always he. I mean, there have only been two. There's the Ayatollah Khomeini, and then there's the Ayatollah Khamenei. It's kind of easy to get confused. And it's an Islamic Republic, but it has real politics, but it's an Islamic Republic. So the supreme leader appoints this group, the Guardian Council, which vet all candidates for public office in elections, all election candidates. The supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is a religious figure, and he will and they will dismiss people. They won't allow people to run if their views are seen as un-Islamic or if they're not seen as sufficiently Islamic. So they have tremendous power over the president, who's in charge of sort of day-to-day executive functions, the civil service and things like that. Yeah. And in fact, Ayatollah Khamenei has actually cashiered previous presidents, basically, like President Ahmadinejad, people may remember.
Yeah.
The current president of Iran is a cleric, Hassan Rouhani, but he's seen as a more liberal cleric because there are real politics in Iran. It's not just a straight-up dictatorship. There are real politics and real elections where people jockey for power. Now, and these figures, Hassan Rouhani and maybe his foreign minister, Javad Zarif, are genuinely interesting people you should follow if you're interested in these things. Javad Zarif on Twitter, you won't be bored. He tweets in English all the time. And they're seen as liberals because they were for the nuclear deal, which is now in tatters, thanks to the killing of Soleimani, among other things. But, Soleimani was against the nuclear deal. Right. So they're seen as liberal. They are liberals in their foreign policy, and they were trying to get better conditions for the Iranian people. But my friends from Iran point out that human rights violations by the regime, by the supposedly liberal regime, are just as bad under Rouhani as they were under Ahmadinejad.
So. Well, then the news this morning where Iran has now admitted to downing the airliner, where does that leave us? And where does it leave the relations between the United States and Iran?
It is a really tricky situation. I'm often struck by how the downing of airliners isn't more political sometimes. Like, we still, it's amazing how we sort of got over the downing of a Malaysian airliner by Ukrainian separatists.
But also America did it in 88.
Yes, indeed. And as you're very right. So they brought down an Iranian airliner, and the Iranians have not forgotten. And they raised it a number of times in the course of the last few days.
Did America also wait 4 or 5 days before admitting to it? Certainly, Iran has done that.
I don't remember exactly the timeline, but it's one of those things where, states are very loath to admit it. That's why I was surprised to wake up this morning to find out that Iran had actually admitted to it. It's harder to hide these things, but, it's a really tragic situation because it's mostly Iranians on that plane, but it's a very repressive regime, even if it's got a complicated politics, and you can't just speak out. The loved ones of those people will not have the same roots to make their voices heard that you would have in the United States of America or in Ireland.
So easier to sweep under the carpet.
Well, it's in a way, it may do sort of lasting, festering damage because people won't be able to sort of demand accountability for it the same way they could in other places.
Okay, well then, this history of the relationship between the United States of America and Iran. Iran is obviously strategically very important, mainly because, why? Because of its kind of long, huge border with Russia.
It's incredibly important for a variety of reasons. It's got a long border with all sorts of things. It's oil rich. It's a big country. It's 80 million people. It's got a 500,000 person army. It has a certain amount of money, even though it's been starved of foreign currency, starved of foreign technology by all the sanctions which have been placed on it since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. So it's incredibly important. It's a Shiite country. It's the only country with a official where Shiism, which is a particular sect of Islam, which believes that the Prophet's son-in-law, Ali, was the rightful imam and not the caliphs who are in the Sunni tradition, which is the other one. Anyway, they are trying to establish a Shiite corridor or crescent all the way to the sea from Iran into Iraq and into Syria, where Shiites form a majority in certain ways. It's a bit complicated. And so Iran's important for what it does, and then it's also important for where it is. And it's a big oil-exporting country, its land is the Gulf of Hormuz, which is a sort of pinch point in the Gulf where a lot of the world's oil flows out of. And so if they disrupt shipping of oil there, then oil prices go up quite dramatically.
It's funny, when it used to be called Persia, used to be, wow, like what an exciting, exotic, blah, blah.
And it is.
Yeah, but since it's been called Iran, it doesn't seem to be, because one of the things is over the last 40 years is what happened in 79 with the revolution. Relations changed, did they, between the United States and Iran, to put it bluntly. They've ebbed and flowed since.
Well, the history of the US and Britain, to another degree as well, with Iran is quite fraught, right? So there was an elected leader, Mossadegh, who was deposed by the U.S. and because they thought he might be crypto-socialist, and they bring back the Shah, who became very, very repressive. I mean, liberal on things like headscarves, but repressive. And in fact, Iranians will tell you that their mother is forced to maybe to wear a headscarf, but their grandmothers were forced to remove their headscarves. You can't win if you're an Iranian woman, I think, over the past few decades. But so they depose Mossadegh, they bring in the Shah, They then, you know, the Shah's repression leads to the a revolution, which is quickly taken over by the Ayatollah Khomeini, which imposes the Islamic Republic. And since then, after the takeover of the U.S. embassy by students, basically, and the incipient Revolutionary Guard, of which Soleimani was one, you know, you have had a whole history of isolation of Iran by the United States with absolutely punishing sanctions, which makes everyday life in Iran very difficult.
Okay, but like it also comes down sometimes to one or two specific incidents that people can grab onto, if it's made into a movie or if it's a headline or whatever. The hostage crisis of around 79 to 81.
Yeah, I mean,
that was huge.
It was huge. It was very, very long. And it was also one of the early sort of moments in which U.S. power was sort of seen to be failing. Right. I mean, there was it all comes down to one epic raid, Jimmy Carter. And this pretty much did for Jimmy Carter. Right. You know, Jimmy Carter sent in a rescue mission, which was a complete fiasco. I mean, planes crashed and they didn't rescue the hostages. And that failure sort of really resonated, I think, in the United States. It made Jimmy Carter look weak and incompetent. It almost certainly handed the election to Ronald Reagan. And there's, you know, this sort of toxic relationship with Iran has colored U.S. politics ever since. I mean, there's all sorts of it's better than a conspiracy theory that basically the Iran delayed the release of the hostages in the embassy until Reagan was elected, right? And then suddenly they did so. And there was some collusion between the Reagan group before they took power and Iran over to make sure that Jimmy Carter was defeated.
Well, then let's jump up not to now, but to the future. Now, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what looks likely to happen next, even with today's news?
Well, quite incredible is the fact that we may be actually returning to normal. It's amazing to watch these choreographed moves in Iran and in the Middle East. And you know, on Tuesday night, I was praying in public that no U.S. casualties would occur as a result of any retaliation Iran took, because Donald Trump had sort of painted himself into a place where if there was a U.S. casualty, he would have to do something provocative again. Right. And that would have led to even further escalation. It seems like Iran told its friends in Iraq, who then told the United States or made it clear to the United States what it was going to do so that all of the U.S. personnel could be in their bunkers when those rockets from Iran hit. And there were no casualties. Donald Trump then, you know, initially responded in an almost super sort of elated fashion about how well it had all gone. And it really does seem like both sides are trying to de-escalate quickly. Now, that doesn't leave out Iran having publicly done something, doing something much more aggressive, possibly through some of its proxies anywhere in the world, like a kind of spectacular terrorist attack, which couldn't be so easily traced to them, which could possibly set off much more dire sort of dynamics.
But is it a terrible thing to say that what's happened now and the admission of guilt, that actually might diffuse that as well?
Yes,
that's
I mean,
a good thing.
Iran,
in terms of the downing of the plane.
Iran will be in mourning today, and it doesn't exactly empower Iran. It's very, again, if you look at Javad Zarif's Twitter feed, it's very hard to combine his sort of angry denunciations of Donald Trump with the admission, which he has. It's the top tweet right now, that Iran did bring down the plane and that their hearts are broken. So it is going to take a lot of the aggression out of the Iranian posture. Now, they are saying the reason that human error was made was because of the climate of fear and anxiety created by Donald Trump's adventurism, as they would put it. So they can still blame Donald Trump partially for this downing of a plane. But it does. It's going to make things it's going to dampen the kind of fire for aggression in Iran right now.
But when there were sort of a lot of protests and when a lot of people were killed by Iran, and so to quell those protests, does Iran always need a kind of an external bogeyman to furnish a kind of a pretext for domestic oppression? And, you know, well, we have to do this because, you know, America's doing this. Like, is it always, like, at Friday prayers, they still chant all the time, death to America.
Yeah, I mean, people have said the death to America is just a sort of a formula. You know, it's like Cade Mila Falcha or something like that. You know, it's that they, not quite, but, you know, it's just something you say. And you know, it's people, you know, maybe a certain number of people actually mean it. But, you know, a lot of people just say it because that's the thing you say. Iran probably does need an external bogeyman. some people have said the U.S. always needs an external bogeyman, and it's still sort of looking for one. Now, they seem to have found at least one in Russia and or China, depending on who you are. But no, in Iran, I mean, Iran has lots of potential foes to whip themselves up against. I mean, much of its actual day-to-day politics or foreign policy is a contest between them and some of the other regional powers, which are Sunni powers, right?
But hold on, the Sunni stuff and the militants, like the Sunni militants and ISIS, etc., is that when the two countries come together? Is that like the two nations have overlapping goals and therefore Iran and U.S. get on because it suits both?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, you know, the Iran and U.S. get on, you know, to an extent. It requires a certain amount of choreography to fight ISIS, right? It's not like you're going to be sharing units together or like in the same space. But yeah, they're generally for the last few years fighting ISIS, they've laid off each other, right? And part of that deal was that they wouldn't target Soleimani, right? Again, Soleimani has...
Part of that deal was that they would not target him,
or even their proxies, because one of the leader of their main proxy in Iraq was also killed in that strike. No, I mean, this is a really complex situation. But yeah, because ISIS seemed like a greater threat, they laid off each other for a while. And because it represented a sort of an existential, well, not an existential threat, but such a serious threat to both Iraq and Syria, you know, they were able to cooperate on the idea, well, these guys are really bad, right? You know, so because they didn't have, ISIS didn't have a lot of proper allies in the region who were prepared to sort of stand up for them, they could be defeated by these very, very powerful forces.
Sometimes I think that like whoever is in charge might be kind of anti. I get the impression a lot of Iranians are quite pro-US.
Well, I mean, a lot of Iranians are in the U.S. I mean, there was a huge flight of Iranians, and I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, and there are large Persian-Iranian sections of L.A.
I saw a guy on TV last night talking about the fact that he was from Canada, and he said, like, the 500,000 Iranians here are very unhappy with what happened. Going, really, that many?
No, and we see it again. We also, with the sort of a lot of the human rights violations which are being committed in Iran, there are a lot of people languishing in Iranian jails who are dual citizens, but Iran doesn't recognize that.
So
kind
on,
of
let's
thing.
Take a look.
So anyway, there's a big diaspora, but again, there's a huge amount of resentment of the regime inside Iran, not least among the vast number of ethnic minorities they have there who are treated very badly by the regime.
Well, there is a real willingness, let's assume, to avoid war on both sides. There should always be. But what sanctions are the USA planning on putting on Iran?
Well, overnight, they've actually finally told us what those sanctions are going to be. And again, I cannot stress enough how hard these sanctions are on the day-to-day life of people in Iran. People are really hurting. That's why fuel prices had to go up, just to pay the bills, and that's what prompted all this resistance. Anyway, there are so many sanctions already on Iran, because when Donald Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal, he reimposed all the sanctions which the deal was supposed to lift, right? So these were banking sanctions, starving it of foreign currency, starving it from the chance of exporting oil, all sorts of other kinds of exports, lots of named sanctions on individuals and organizations and companies in Iran, pressure put on other countries to keep their companies out of Iran. I mean, we have to remember that Meng Wanzhou, who's the Huawei executive who was arrested in Canada on the U.S.'s request, it was about violating sanctions on Iran. So there were already tons of sanctions. The new sanctions, which were announced just in the last 24 hours, were on steel and iron, which is a big export and big commodity in Iran. And then, as we might have expected, raising the penalties for previous sanction violations and naming some more individuals and companies.
Okay, well then finally, the effect that this might have on Donald Trump's re-election chances, if any, what does this do?
Again, he seems quite happy with it because he feels like it's testing well with audiences out there. And that was his main reaction. It's like, this is going well, people like it, you know. And it gives him another talking point at his rallies where he said, no, not only did I kill al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, but I killed Soleimani as well. And it allows, I mean, these two narratives are there in the United States to be had, and people are taking them on a partisan basis. Donald Trump's a tough guy. The Democrats, on the other hand, love terrorists. This is an actual quotation from a Republican official, right? Whereas the Democrats can say he's impulsive, he has no plan, he, you know, doesn't respect any kind of international norms. Bottom line is, Americans don't really care about foreign policy when they're voting, unless it's a proper land war and bodies are coming home every week.
All politics are local politics. All right, listen, Graham, thank you very much indeed for coming into us on the programme this morning. That's Graham Finley, lecturer from the School of Politics at University College Dublin. Thanks, Graham.
Dave Fanning.
Weekends on 2FM. 2.